From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Republicans in the Senate are getting to work on their version of a health care bill after the House passed the American Health Care Act last week. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has put together a working group on the issue. 13 senators, many of the most conservative members, and no women. NPR's congressional correspondent Susan Davis joins us now. Hi, Susan.
Hey, Jeremy.
And what's going on with this working group? Is McConnell playing a shrewd political game here by including these conservative members but excluding more moderate Republicans like Susan Collins or Lisa Murkowski? Or could this backfire, considering the Republicans can afford to lose far fewer votes in the Senate than they can in the House?
Well, you know, that's one of the many questions we're going to have. The working group met for the first time today. We were told the first topic up on the agenda was Medicaid and what to do with that program. You know, the Senate Majority Leader has sort of maybe has made the calculation that conservatives need to be on board if this can get through the Senate. Remember, there's only 52 Republicans in that chamber, so he can only lose two votes and still get this through the chamber because it's not subjected to a Democratic filibuster. I talked to one of the women in the Senate yesterday, Maine Senator Susan Collins, and asked her, you know, do you have a problem with not being included in this group? And this is what she had to say.
The leaders have the right to choose whomever they wish. It doesn't mean that I'm not going to work on health care. I've worked on health care for many years. I spent 5 years in state government overseeing the Bureau of Insurance many years ago, and I think I can bring some experience to the debate that will be helpful.
As you can hear there, obviously Susan Collins is not just going to sit back. She plans to have a very important role in this. And that was something we heard from a lot of other female senators. Hey, we're not in the working group, but we're going to make our positions heard.
Well, what do we know about what the senators are crafting and how different it will be from the House bill?
The Senate has kind of taken the attitude when the House passed their bill to say, okay, thanks, and sort of pushed it off to the side and said, we're going to do our own thing. You know, the core fundamentals of the bill, Republicans largely agree on. They want to repeal the individual mandate that tells people they have to buy insurance, and they want to scrap most of the taxes that were implemented under the Affordable Care Act. Two things in the House bill that we've heard repeatedly the Senate wants to take a really close look at. One is what the House bill did to pre-existing condition protections and sort of allowing a pathway for states to opt out of these conditions and what they have to cover for essential health benefits. The second thing we've heard them say they want to take a really close look at is what the House bill does on Medicaid. The House bill would essentially take the Medicaid program from a federal guarantee and make it into either a block grant program or a per capita program, which means essentially that states would just get a set amount of money and would have to make more of the costs on their own. There's a lot of concerns there that reducing Medicaid spending could leave people out in the cold. And there's a lot of senators who want to take a very fine-tooth comb through that.
Well, when you say a fine-tooth comb or take a close look, do you mean that they're likely to take it out?
I don't know. No. I mean, I can't presume to guess what the Senate's going to do, but we do know that there's a lot of Senate discomfort over the idea that their states, remember, senators think about more broadly about their whole state than a lot of House members do, about, you know, does that leave their governors in a jam? So, and we've heard from very prominent Republican governors like Ohio's John Kasich and Arkansas Governor Hutchinson that they have concerns about this and that they don't want to see less federal money that would squeeze their states.
What's the timeline on the Senate effort?
You know, they have to pass a bill by the end of September. The process by which they're doing this bill turns into a pumpkin then at the end of the fiscal year. They're hoping the broad brush I've heard is a month or two. They've made very clear they don't feel that they're going to rush on this. And so it's probably going to be weeks, if not months, before we actually see a Senate bill.
Now, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office has said that 24 million fewer Americans will be covered under the House Republican plan than are currently covered. This is something that a lot of Republicans have been very hesitant to try to defend. They don't want to defend that people are going to be losing their health care. But conservative commentator Charles Krauthammer took it a step further and thinks that basically Republicans are being pushed into a corner where they have to accept that the idea of everybody being covered is a good idea. He says we'll have a single-payer system in 7 years in this country. Here he is on Fox News last Thursday.
Republicans are not arguing the free market. They have sort of accepted the fact that the electorate sees health care as not just any commodity. It's not like purchasing a steak or a car. It's something that people now have a sense the government ought to guarantee.
That's a right.
Just a few seconds left here, Susan, but what are your thoughts on that?
I do not believe that Republicans in Congress believe that single payer is the way to go, and that's certainly not the way they're moving. There's an argument that if they are incapable of passing this legislation, that eventually moving more towards a single payer system would be more likely because they were unable to pass the conservative alternative.
That's NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis. Thank you.
Thank you.
Today, the Trump administration postponed a meeting to decide whether the U.S. would pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement, but the administration is making its position known on scientists. The EPA has dismissed at least 5 and as many as 9 members of its 18-member Board of Scientific Counselors, which reviews EPA research and programs. New EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt, who sued the EPA as Attorney General of Oklahoma, says he wants to replace academic scientists with industry insiders who understand the impact of regulations. Congress is also looking at changing the EPA's much larger Scientific Advisory Board to include more non-academics. Robert Richardson is associate professor at Michigan State University and was one of those whose tenure at the 18-member research board was not renewed. He joins us. And Professor, last week when you were terminated, you tweeted out, "It had been a pleasure to be on the board, but you were trumped." Now, President Trump has made it clear he wants more industry in the EPA. He's asked for agency budget reductions of 40% in some cases. So were you surprised?
In some ways, the news is not surprising for the reasons that you've described. It was unexpected to receive it in the way that it was received. The executive committee of this board had met in person in January, had given us the impression that their intent was certainly to renew the appointments of these 9 board members whose appointments were up for renewal. So to receive the news late on a Friday was simply surprising and unexpected because of what I had been led to believe prior to this.
Well, the New York Times quotes an EPA spokesperson as saying the agency wants to take as inclusive an approach to regulation as possible. Respond to this claim by the administration and its backers that there aren't enough industry people on the boards.
These boards are made up of a diverse group of individuals, including university scientists and engineers, but also members representing civil society, non-governmental organizations, municipal and state governments, and the private sector. So there is already a diverse voice represented in these boards. This board reviews science and scientific outputs and gives feedback and recommendations to the Office of Research and Development. So it has no role in reviewing or approving or even giving feedback on regulations. So that is not a function of the board, and it misrepresents its purpose.
Well, there's your board. There's also the Science Advisory Board. It was Representative Lamar Smith from Texas, chair of the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology, who wrote the bill that the House passed that would reshuffle the deck on that board. And he was very clear. He said, in recent years, Science Advisory Board members have become nothing more than rubber stamps who approve all of the EPA's regulations. The EPA routinely stacks this board with friendly scientists who receive millions of dollars in grants from the federal government. What about that charge? It's the same charge that people, on the other side of the aisle might make of industry captains being on these science boards. But here is someone saying that you scientists have a conflict here because you get research grants from the government.
Members of these boards go through annual ethics compliance and conflict of interest compliance where we are required to state any conflicts should they exist. And we have to reach consensus when we provide reports to the agency that reflects the shared agreement of members of the board. So I do take some objection to Representative Smith's comments. Also, we do not receive funding from the EPA when we're serving in this capacity because of the conflict of interest statements that you've just suggested.
Look, what's your concern? People might say, well, maybe it's a good thing to bring more industry into these panels because then industry might better understand some of the scientific issues. What is your concern?
Well, as I said, industry is represented as a voice.
Right.
Credible scientists from industry are members of these various boards. When you refer to the larger picture of the kinds of things I have read about, the House bill that would make major changes to the role of the Science Advisory Board, the president's budget, which would be slated to cut, I think, 84% of the Science Advisory Board's budget, changes in the way science information is being presented on websites. These kinds of things, when I read about them, give me grave concern about the role of objective science in contributing to the mission of the Environmental Protection Agency, which is to protect human health and the environment, which I think we should all agree is very valuable in light of the importance of air quality and access to drinking water and safe communities to live in.
And you tweeted, you've got one planet, what are you prepared to do with it? Create jobs? That seems awfully short-sighted and narrow-minded. Professor Robert Richardson, an associate professor in the Department of Community Sustainability at Michigan State University, and one of the academic scientists removed from his position on the EPA's Board of Scientific Counselors. Professor, thank you.
Thank you, Robin. It was a pleasure to be with you.
All this week, we're looking at privatization in America. Today, we'll talk about efforts to privatize public education through charter schools and voucher programs, which advocates often refer to as school choice. President Trump supports expanding school choice, and in his budget blueprint, he calls for cutting $9.2 billion from the Education Department and for shifting $1.4 billion to expand school choice initiatives. We're joined now by Sam Abrams via Skype. He's the director of the National Center for the Study of Privatization in Education at Columbia University's Teachers College, and he's the author of the book Education and the Commercial Mindset. Sam Abrams, take us back to the beginning of the idea that market forces should shape public education.
We can go back to Milton Friedman with this. He wrote an important essay in 1955 called The Role of Government in Education. And Friedman's argument was that parents should be able to shop for schools in the same way they shop for anything else and use vouchers to do that shopping. And Friedman thought that this would help students in poor neighborhoods escape poor neighborhoods. He specified that the vouchers would be worth a certain amount of money, and private schools could charge more than that specified sum. But his concern fundamentally was improving the quality of education for all children and giving parents more latitude.
And how many more parents have that latitude now? How much has this idea of vouchers caught on around the country?
That's a great question. Milwaukee is the city where this really began. It took a long time to catch on in the United States. So that started in 1990. There are about 28,000 students in Milwaukee. Across the country, we have programs in Cleveland, D.C. We have nearly 100,000 in Florida. And we have quite a few in Arizona now. The number of students using vouchers, however, is not that great. The alternative form of choice has really been charter schools, which were much less controversial in the public eye than vouchers.
And charter schools, by the way, some of them are public schools, right? They're considered public schools.
We can consider all charter schools to be public schools. There's a lot of debate about this, but they're publicly financed, privately managed schools. Some of them are run for profit, about 13% of them. About 7,000 of our schools across the country, of 100,000 publicly financed schools, are charter schools. And of that 7,000, about 750 are run for profit. But they are open to all students through lotteries if oversubscribed. So they can be considered technically public schools.
But you consider charter schools to be part of the privatization of education?
They are part of the privatization of education in that privatization technically means outsourcing the management of a service for the public to a private provider. So in that regard, charter schools constitute a privatized form of the delivery of education.
And advocates of all of this would say this is giving parents more choice. That's the word that is often used, choice in education. What do you say to that?
It does. It does give parents more choice. The big question is, does it provide choice for better education, or is it just a different door that students are going through, but the education isn't necessarily better and sometimes might be inferior than what students would get at their default neighborhood public school?
Does the proliferation of all of these charter schools and voucher programs and the privatization in general of education, does it hurt public schools? Can we look at the research and say this is making the rest of the public schools worse?
There is an argument to be made in that regard, because what we have happening is a certain kind of atomization. The neighborhood isn't the neighborhood that it once was, because you have students crossing school districts to go to different schools. So the community involvement in the neighborhood public school has been lost. Moreover, because we have this sorting of good schools and so-called bad schools, with a lot of the students who can abide by the high academic and behavioral expectations at the demanding charter schools, then you have students who can't abide by those high academic and behavioral expectations get concentrated in the default neighborhood public schools. And we do have research that shows that when you have that concentration, they cause problems for other kids.
What about the performance of the kids who are going to the regular public schools versus, let's say, a charter school or a private school? Are we seeing differences, big differences in the performance?
In some particular charter networks, there is a significant difference. You have KIPP, Achievement First, Uncommon Schools, Democracy Prep. These are very well-funded networks. So in some of these cases, we do have some impressive results, but we have to take into consideration that these are networks that work for a subset of students who can abide by these steep academic and behavioral expectations, and these networks have a lot of philanthropic funding to make it possible. In general, however, we don't see any significant difference. Now, in fairness to advocates of choice, however, there is the choice that is necessarily being exercised. So it may not be academic results that they're interested in. It could be just the exercise of choice itself.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Sam Abrams, who's the director of the National Center for the Study of Privatization in Education at Columbia University's Teachers College. And let me ask you about something else, Sam Abrams. What about testing, all the testing that's going on around the country? Is that a part of the privatization in education in America? Because these companies are private, right, that do the testing.
I wouldn't say the testing itself is a product of privatization. This was mandated by the federal government with No Child Left Behind in 2002. And we had a lot of states who were mandating this kind of testing a decade earlier. And you do have these companies who not only benefit from this mandated testing, but they also manufacture need with a lot of benchmark assessments throughout the year to prepare students for these exams. I see the testing, though, as a product not so much of privatization, but of this commercial mindset, and that we like to think of everything in terms of profits and losses. And reading and math scores comport with that vision of how schools work as any aspect of our economy works.
But some people would look at that and say, that's just accountability.
Right. However, there are better ways, I would argue, to get accountability. We can do deep sampling. And in fact, that's what the Finns do. They just sample 10% of ninth grade and a longitudinal sample of students from third grade, sixth grade, ninth grade, and 12th grade in mathematics. And they get terrific evidence of progress. And all of the pressure for accountability that has resulted in this kind of testing has interfered with the school day, and it's crowded out time for instruction in art and music and crafts. We're not even having as much instruction in history and science as we should.
So let's talk about what is going to happen in the future when it comes to privatization in education. Betsy DeVos is the education secretary. She's a big fan of charter schools and vouchers. Let's listen here to her during her confirmation hearing. Senator Patty Murray, a Democrat from Washington State, asked DeVos if she could commit that she would not privatize public schools or cut a single penny from public education. Here's what DeVos said.
We acknowledge today that not all schools are working for the students that are assigned to them. And I'm hopeful that we can work together to find common ground and ways that we can solve those issues and empower parents to make choices on behalf of their children that are right for them.
I take that as not being willing to commit to not privatizing public schools or cutting money from education.
Well, I guess I wouldn't characterize it in that way.
Well, okay.
What do we know at this point about what DeVos actually is going to do on this front?
Well, from her visit to a Catholic school with Donald Trump in Orlando several weeks ago, we know that she's a big fan of tuition tax credits, which become vouchers for poor children. So she can lobby for that. How she can make it happen at the federal level is another question. There isn't that much money in the federal budget for education. So it's a bit of a mystery about how she can really make privatization take that much more hold across the country.
But also, it's probably the case that a lot could happen without her.
Oh, much can happen without her, and that's already happened recently in Arizona. We have a push in Nevada that's in the court system right now about making money available to all parents, regardless of income, so they can send their children to private school. And it may be the case that this will spread to other states. It seems to be the case.
That's Sam Abrams, who is the director of the National Center for the Study of Privatization in Education at Columbia University's Teachers College, part of our series this week on privatization in America. Sam, thank you.
You bet.
And tomorrow we will talk about privatization and the military. Your thoughts, welcome at hereandnow.org. Fights broke out at the Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport in Florida yesterday when passengers upset about flight cancellations rushed a Spirit Airlines ticket counter, and there have been hundreds of cancellations in the last week for the discount carrier. Spirit claims the pilots' union is causing a slowdown, which the pilots deny. Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. He joins us from New York. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Jeremy.
So on Sunday alone, 81 Spirit flights were canceled, nearly 20% of the flights for the company that day. What's behind this? Is it the pilots or not?
Well, just for a little context, Spirit is a deep discount carrier, the likes of which we don't have a lot in the United States. So it generally enjoys a poorer record than even the poor record of most mainstream airlines. But there is a negotiation going on with the pilots. Spirit says the pilots are not making themselves available. The language is very vague. The pilots deny this is happening. The pilots' union say they're in a negotiation. They definitely have some beefs with their compensation package, but they're not admitting that they're slowing anything down. The airline says it's the pilots. There have been 300 flights canceled since the beginning of May.
I remember a couple of years ago, actually back in 2012, the same kind of thing happened with American Airlines.
Yep.
With their pilots. And I remember sitting on a flight and then it was just canceled for no reason. And people, I mean, this makes people very upset. Let's listen here to one passenger who spoke with CBS News, Debbie McCrandy, who was trying to get home to Detroit after taking a cruise.
This is actually our third Spirit flight that has been canceled since Thursday. I slept in an airport in Philly already on Thursday night, and I don't want to sleep in an airport again tonight.
Can't blame her, but
no.
are Spirit customers going to abandon Spirit over this? Or?
Well, they are. I mean, Spirit is so much less expensive to fly. I mean, they have some fares that are $20, $30, $40. Now, you don't get anything with that. You can't bring baggage on the plane, can't check baggage, can't do any of that without paying extra. The problem here, and we've learned this from the United incident, the passengers don't want to understand how your sausage is made at the airline. They believe that when they buy a ticket, it's a contract for passage from one place to another at a particular time. And Spirit is having an issue with its pilots. It needs to work that out because passengers do get frustrated. Again, it is many times cheaper to fly Spirit than it is to fly United or Delta or American. So some people end up on Spirit because it's the only affordable option. But this can't go on for too much longer. The federal government might get involved if it does.
Is it a good time to be a pilot right now when it comes to pay?
So it's very interesting. I'm in the process of getting my pilot's license.
Oh.
It's not a well-paid job now, but there is a massive pilot shortage. shortage coming. So American Airlines has done something very differently to these concerns about labor. They introduced a mid-contract wage hike for both pilots and flight attendants last week. So you may not have to pay your pilots more right now, but you are going to have to pay your pilots more in the future. So it's not a great time to be a pilot now, but it will be.
And just briefly, Ellie, I mean, this is coming amid all of these videos that keep showing up of people being dragged off of flights and other things. Does it all fit together?
It does. Look, airlines are pinched. Airline travel has not increased along with the rate of inflation over the last 20 or 25 years. So what's happened is customer service has suffered. There aren't extra airplanes. There aren't extra pilots and flight attendants. So we're paying the price for it.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Thanks so much as always.
My pleasure.
It's Here and Now.
Here's a line from the Washington Post review of the new NBC sitcom Great News. The gods of television have blessed us with a wacky, weird, and wonderful TV mother. Well, of course she is. She's Andrea Martin, who plays a mom who gets an internship on the TV show produced by her daughter, What Could Go Wrong? Her daughter played by Briga Helin.
Since when has it been your dream to work in the news?
Since always! But then I met your father and quit my job to raise you.
Okay. Mom, you do not want to be an intern. It is boring and thankless.
Boring and thankless. I was a mom for 30 years. I cleaned barf out of the tape deck of a Teddy Ruxpin.
That would be a talking stuffed bear. Now, we know Andrea Martin's capable of running an entire TV station, as she did on Canadian TV's fabulous SCTV back in the 70s and 80s. It was based on a fictional TV station. It launched Martin Short, the late John Candy, Eugene Levy. Andrea Martin played station manager and sometime host Edith Prickly.
Hello, ladies. Prickly again. You know, every meal can be a picnic if you just get off your buns and get back in the kitchen where you belong. But I know how you feel, though. You spend the afternoon in the living room, sitting in an easy chair, sipping a margarita and watching old Merv on the old boob tube. Then you realize you got 5 minutes to whip up something for the hubby and the kids, right? Prickly knows.
Andrea Martin has also appeared in a number of films, who can forget Aunt Vula, in both My Big Fat Greek Weddings. She's got 2 Tonys for her stage work, most recently Bertha, the literally swinging grandma up in the air on a swing in the 2013 revival of Pippin.
Oh, it's time to start living, time to take a little from this world we're given, time to take time, 'cause spring will turn to fall. In just no time at all.
And now Andrea Martin's in not one, but 2 TV shows. We mentioned Great News, but also Hulu's Difficult People. And Andrea Martin is standing by at the NPR studios in New York.
Let me come on to you. Shuma Bilinthaya.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. What were you whispering?
What was I right then?
Yeah.
I'm about to start a movie where I'm an Italian woman, and so I was saying in Italian, mi chiamo Andrea, and then I was saying in French, because I studied at the Sorbonne, je m'appelle Andrea, and then I was thinking to myself, huh, not bad. And then you said, why are you whispering? Oh, my God. Welcome to the mind of Andrea Martin.
Well, and we're so thrilled to be even next to it. Can we talk about Great News? The younger colleagues in this fictional newsroom call your character an old, because, you know, you are 70 in real life, but as the Washington Post says, you blow everybody else away in energy and in that slightly unhinged look that you get. How satisfying is that? There is something that comes with having done this for a long time and this sense of you, I mean, you've just mastered it.
You know, I know a lot of what I'm doing and I'm always learning, and I learned so much from Briga, who plays my daughter, and Nicole Richie, who are certainly a younger generation, and Tracy Wigfield, who wrote it, who's 33.
Whose mother, by the way, is Kathy Wigfield, who apparently is known by everyone in the comedy world, and their relationship inspired this. Have you met Kathy, the real-life mother?
Yes, and thank God I did, because she has a quality that I don't have really in life, which is that she has no filter at all. She just says whatever's on her mind. And I don't mean in an obnoxious way. I mean in a terribly refreshing way. She is not intimidated by anybody. She treats the president the same way she would treat the taxi driver who dropped her off at work. And she loves her daughter unconditionally, is not afraid, nor does she remotely think she's boring when she tells everybody every inch of Tracy's life and what she's accomplished. So that quality, that kind of effortless enthusiasm and the genuine love for her daughter, it was a great quality for me to get.
Well, it seems like you've captured her. Here's a scene in which your character, Carol, again inspired by Kathy, is talking to Chuck, the blowhard anchor played by John Michael Higgins.
Does my hair look gray on camera? It's just that nobody around here tells me the truth.
Your hair does look gray.
Thank you, Carol.
And also, Chuck, when you wear a green tie, you look exactly like a leprechaun. It's because of your ears.
Baby steps, Carol. Baby steps.
Oh, there you go. When I mentioned SCTV, those of us who know it with a cult fervor. Why? What do you think was the draw?
You're absolutely right, a cult following. I mean, Martin Scorsese says that it got him through his directing films in the 70s and so many. Tina Fey, for goodness sakes, and Amy Poehler produces Difficult People, the one I do for Hulu. So it definitely made its mark. I don't know if it's because we were away from meddling networks or producers or the press or the media, anything to distract us. There was nothing. So we were virtually acting for each other. We didn't even have an audience. And I think when you get seven organically funny people in a room and there's no one stopping that intuition, wonderful things happen.
Good day. Good day. Good day. Good day. How's it going? I'm Bob McKenzie. It's my brother, Doug.
How's it going, today?
We got two topics today, back bacon and long underwear. Like, they're different topics, right? Okay, first topic. Well, I don't know which one should be first. Which one should...
Go long underwear and then food as a reward.
Okay. Well, those moments that do happen, you know, Sid Caesar. I mean, they just seem to happen where, I mean, what are the chances you're going to get Martin Short, the late John Candy, Rick Moranis, Harold Ramis, Catherine O'Hara, you, Eugene Levy? What, I mean, something has to happen.
I wonder if, you know, when you mention all those names and they're all so extraordinary, if we had all been put in various other shows and weren't together, I wonder if we would have had the opportunity to blossom like we did. Yeah. And my feeling is we probably wouldn't have. When you name those people like that, sometimes I think I'm not one of them. You know, I just listen. I think, oh, my God, what a great group of people. And then realize, wait, I was part of that.
Yeah.
I do. First of all, it was many, many years ago, right? And so it feels almost like a memory. But I love all those actors that you mentioned. Harold's no longer with us, and of course, John isn't. But the rest of us are very close. And I feel really grateful to have had that time in my life.
Well, and I know, I mean, we keep saying you've got two new programs. Obviously, a film you've got to go make. But can we just listen to a scene from My Big Fat Greek Wedding? You play Vula?
Yes.
The aunt of the bride. And in this scene, Vula meets the prospective in-laws for the first time. And, of course, just like your – you know, you also don't have a filter in this character. You can't help sharing some medical history. Let's listen.
I had a lump at the back of my neck right here. Always a lump. Then I start the menopause and the lump got bigger. From the hormones, it started to grow. So I go to the doctor and he did the biopsy. Inside the lump, he found teeth and a spinal column.
How much fun do you have?
I have so much fun. But when you play all these things back, I think, geez, I've been blessed with some great writers. I mean, Nia Vardalos wrote that. I didn't improvise. You know, I might have said Babopsy differently. And Tracy Wigfield writes that really funny scene that you played from Great News. And Here's the deal. It persists in being fun. It never gets tired or old, and I'm always excited with each project, and I always approach it like, oh, my God, maybe I can't do it this time, and what if I can't? And I don't know. That keeps me going, I guess, the need to do it well.
Well, we have to say that we are seated here in Boston where the American Rep Theater is, so, of course, we were front row when Pippin was first launched here. You eventually won a Tony on Broadway when Pippin went to Broadway. But when you climbed up on that swing.
That trapeze. I've been lucky. Thank you for mentioning all these wonderful things.
Well, I mean, it's not like you're done yet. It's just that we just had a chance at you. So actress and comedian Andrea Martin, she currently stars in the NBC show Great News. She's also got the Hulu series Difficult People. It returns for season 3 this August. And as we heard, she's off to make a film in Italy or something. So she has to go. Andrea Martin.
Yeah. Mi chiamo Andrea. La donna mangia un uovo. I don't know. That means the woman eats an egg. There's no place in the movie for that, but that's the only thing I know from the Rosetta Stone. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
President Trump has just nominated his first federal lower court judges, a slate of 10 yesterday, 5 to appellate courts, 5 to district courts. And it's just the beginning. There are currently 129 vacancies on federal courts that the president has the power to fill. Emily Bazelon is a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine and a fellow at Yale Law School. She's with us now. Hi, Emily.
Hello.
And how would you describe this first slate of judicial nominees from the president?
These are reliably conservative lawyers and judges. Some of them are judges in state courts. And so what we're seeing here is the kind of slate that has been handpicked by the Federalist Society, a conservative organization that will really please people who want conservative results from the judiciary and also the conservative intellectual part of the legal academy and the law profession.
Any names that we would know of people who've just been nominated?
I kind of doubt it, but I'll tell you a few of them anyway.
Sure.
Joan Larson has been a justice on the Supreme Court of Michigan. She's someone who was on Trump's list for a potential Supreme Court nomination. That's also true of David Strass, who is a justice in Minnesota. And Judge Amal Thapar has been nominated to the Federal Court of Appeals. He's currently a district court judge. So those are three names that have come up before when we've been talking about potential candidates for a later Supreme Court nomination.
Well, and we focus so much on the people who are nominated for the Supreme Court, but in fact, the vast majority of cases in this country never make it to the Supreme Court. These lower courts are very important. Give us a sense of that, of how important the lower courts are.
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up because it is really crucial. You know, most people who get to court, into federal court, their cases never make it anywhere near the Supreme Court. Usually they're resolved at the district court level. That's the first place you go. And then sometimes they go up to the federal courts of appeal. And so the findings of fact that district court judges make are really crucial. That's when you build a record that all the appellate judges after that use in evaluating the case. And then the appellate courts really make the law in a lot of cases and a lot of areas of law for the different regions of the country. So these are really important positions on the bench. And you're right, we often underplay that.
As we said, there are 129 federal court vacancies right now. How does that number compare to what other presidents have had?
It's pretty high. So the total number of judges with lifetime tenure on the federal bench is 870. So 129 is already a pretty good fraction, about 12 or 13% of the total. And what's also interesting is when you look at the age of a lot of federal judges on the bench and you anticipate that some vacancies are going to come about because people are going to want to retire, you can see that Trump is really poised to potentially fill more vacancies than anyone in 40 years before the presidency of Gerald Ford. So we're talking about the beginning of what could be a much larger wave of Trump judicial appointments.
Is part of the reason why there are so many vacancies because Republicans refuse to confirm President Obama's nominees for these courts?
Yes, it's a combination of the vacancies that Trump inherited, and some of that was because the Republicans were, you know, obstructing or kind of slow walking some Obama nominations. And then there's just this kind of demographic happy coincidence from the point of view of Trump in terms of creating the potential for a lot more vacancies.
And he's got a Republican Senate now, so he's going to have an easier time getting these nominees through, presumably.
That's right. And, you know, you can remember the history here when Harry Reid was the Senate Majority Leader for the Democrats. He ended the filibuster for these lower court nominations. Now, of course, Mitch McConnell for the Republicans has ended it for Supreme Court vacancies. But we have a history with lower court vacancies, especially when the party in power of the Senate also controls the presidency, of a pretty easy ride toward confirmation.
Emily, I want to ask you about one other thing, which is that there's been this speculation that there's going to be another Supreme Court vacancy this summer. President Trump has talked about it. Republican Senator Chuck Grassley, they think there will be a retirement from the court. People think that that's likely to be Anthony Kennedy. What are you hearing about that?
I'm hearing rumors about this, too, from inside the judiciary and the legal academy. I can't say for sure that's what's happening, but there are definitely starting to be inklings that it could happen. And, you know, if Anthony Kennedy wants to be replaced by a Republican president, the next year before a potential change of control of the Senate would be, from his point of view, good timing. And I think there's also something very reliably conservative and also smart about the judicial picks that Trump has made so far that could reassure Kennedy. You know, if he was worried that he was going to be replaced by some really off-the-wall kind of judge, we're just that is not what we're actually seeing right now.
That's Emily Bazelon, a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine and fellow at Yale Law School. Emily, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
And South Koreans have elected the liberal candidate Moon Jae-in as their next president this afternoon on All Things Considered. We'll hear about what his victory means for South Korea's relations with the U.S. and with North Korea. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.